Okay, so let's unpack this. Picture yourself standing in front of a vending machine.
A very relatable scenario.
Right. It's about 3 in the afternoon. You are hitting that mid-afternoon slump and you want a soda.
You got the change in your pocket.
Exactly. You have the money, you see the button, and you press it. The can clatters down, you crack it open, and you drink it. Simple, right?
It seems simple.
But here is the question that has been breaking brains for literally 3,000 years. Did you actually choose to press that button?
Or were you just, a biological domino falling over because the domino right behind you pushed it?
Yes, it is the ultimate showdown. And I'm not talking about a boxing match here. I'm talking about the heavyweight championship of philosophy.
The big one.
In one corner, you have free will, that deep intuitive feeling that you are the captain of your own ship, steering your life.
We all feel that way.
We do. But then in the other corner, you have the universe, physics, biology, cause and effect, which suggests the ship is just on autopilot. The course is locked in, and that steering wheel you're holding.
It's just a plastic toy glued to the dashboard.
Exactly, a total illusion.
It really is the me versus the mechanics of reality problem. And usually people think you have to pick a side. It's a binary choice.
Right. It feels like this paradox we just can't shake. Either I'm free and physics is somehow wrong, or physics is right and I'm just a biological robot with delusions of grandeur.
But today we are taking a deep dive into the mind of a guy who looked at those two options and basically said, "No thanks, I'll take a third option."
We are looking at the work of the 17th century powerhouse, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz.
A truly fascinating figure. He was a polymath, a mathematician, a Christian thinker, and a man who genuinely believed he could solve this puzzle without compromising either side.
And looking at the source material we have today, it paints him as a guy in a really, really tight spot. I love how the text describes it. He was effectively caught between the devil and the deep blue sea.
That is a very accurate way to put it, because to understand Leibniz, you have to understand exactly who he was arguing against. He was surrounded by absolute giants.
Right.
On one side, you had the hardliners, thinkers like Thomas Hobbes and Baruch Spinoza.
The you're a robot camp.
Essentially, yes. For Hobbes and Spinoza, freedom is effectively just a comforting illusion. They believe that while we might feel like we are making free choices, that experience is just a confused idea.
It's just ignorance of the causes.
Exactly. If you knew the physics of your brain perfectly, if you could track every single atom and every neuron, you'd see you had absolutely no choice but to want that soda.
Which is, well, it's bleak, it's depressing. You are just a cog turning because the cog behind you pushed you. But then on the other side of the debate, you have René Descartes.
Right. And Descartes goes to the complete opposite extreme. He believed in this strict mind-body dualism where the human will operates in what our source calls a causal vacuum.
A causal vacuum.
Yeah, think of it as total indeterminism. He argued that the mind is this separate entity, a ghost in the machine, and it isn't pushed around by physical causes at all. It just acts spontaneously.
So Leibniz is standing there looking at this menu. Option A, you're a robot and nothing you do matters. Option B, you're a ghost acting completely randomly, which doesn't make much sense either.
And he says, "I have to find a way through the middle."
And that is the mission of today's deep dive. We are going to explore how Leibniz tries to thread this incredibly tiny needle. How can we be truly free if we have a nature that is pre-programmed?
And the even bigger, darker question that comes with it. If there is a God who knows everything and designed this programming, is he responsible for the evil in the world?
It is a massive heavy lift. So let's get right into the engine room. Leibniz builds his whole worldview on something called monads. Now, every time I read that word, I immediately think of some sci-fi alien race.
It does sound like sci-fi.
What are we actually dealing with here?
Well, think of a monad as an individual substance. It is the fundamental unit of reality. For Leibniz, the universe isn't made of dead atoms bouncing off each other like billiard balls. It's made of monads.
Okay.
And unlike atoms, monads have an inner nature.
An inner nature.
Yes. Leibniz develops a teleological metaphysic, which is just a fancy way of saying everything has a purpose, a goal, or a direction built right into its software.
Built in.
He argues that everything a monad does comes from inside it, not from being pushed around by something outside.
Okay, hold on. I need to wrap my head around this. If I am a monad or made of them, and everything I do comes from my inner nature, that sounds a lot like the robot scenario again.
It does.
It sounds like inner determinism. If I'm programmed to be a soda drinker and I drink the soda because of my code, am I actually free?
That is the million-dollar question. And Leibniz knows this is a trap. He admits that Yes, everything acts according to its nature. You will always do what you are most inclined to do. You can't just jump out of your own skin.
So where's the freedom?
He draws a very fine, very important distinction between inclination and compulsion.
Inclination versus compulsion. Unpack that for us.
He says that causes incline the will, but they do not compel it. There is no absolute necessitation. Just because the scale is tipped heavily to one side doesn't mean it's locked in place. You are being nudged, perhaps shoved, but not forced.
The source material gave a really great example of this. It's the He-Man example, which I love, mostly because I'm picturing an 80s cartoon character holding a sword aloft.
It is a fantastic visual. So let's play this out. Imagine you have the greatest passion in the world. You are incredibly thirsty. You've been running a marathon in the desert.
Okay, I'm with you.
Your whole nature, your biological programming, is screaming at you to drink water. That is a massive inclination.
The pressure is completely on. It feels like I have no choice. My body is taking over.
It feels that way. But, Leibniz argues, the soul can still find a reason to resist drinking. And here's the kicker. Even if that reason is completely petty.
Petty.
Even if it's just to show off your power to resist, to prove you're a He-Man.
So I can stand there, totally parched, lips cracking, looking at a glass of ice water, and say, no. I am the master of my domain. Watch me suffer.
Exactly. You might refuse the water just to prove a philosophical point.
That is such a human thing to do. I'm going to make myself miserable just to prove I'm free.
But it proves the point perfectly. It shows that we are never in a state of perfect indifference. We always have a bias, a tilt. But we aren't that causal vacuum Descartes talked about, nor are we the robot Spinoza talked about.
We're somewhere in the middle.
We retain a power of contrary choice. You aren't a stone rolling down a hill. You're a hiker who really, really wants to go downhill, but could, in theory, stop and climb back up.
Okay, so I'm not a neutral observer, but I'm not a slave either. I'm heavily biased. I can work with that. But this brings us to the theological headache that Leibniz has to deal with next.
Yes, the big one.
Because Leibniz isn't just talking about biology or psychology here. He's talking about God.
Right, and this is where the stakes get infinite.
If God created these monads and God created their natures and God knows absolutely everything, doesn't he know exactly what I'm going to do before I do it? Doesn't he know I'm going to drink the soda or play the He-Man before the universe was even built?
This is the fate and foreknowledge problem. And Leibniz doubles down here. He introduces the idea of the perfect concept.
Which is what?
He says that in the mind of God, there's a concept of you, the host concept. And that concept includes every single thing that can ever be truthfully said about you.
Everything.
Your height, your hair color, what you ate for breakfast today, what you'll say 5 minutes from now, and where you'll be in 20 years. It is all in the file folder labeled you before you even exist.
That is terrifying. It means the script is already written. It's in the folder.
Effectively, yes. And this gets really sticky when we look at the bad stuff. The source uses biblical figures as the prime case studies. Specifically, Peter and Judas.
Right, the classic examples. Peter, the disciple who denied Jesus 3 times, and Judas, who betrayed him.
Leibniz says that in the perfect concept of Peter, the denial is already there. God didn't look into a crystal ball to see what Peter would do. God looked at the definition of this specific Peter. The denial is part of who this Peter is.
Whoa, that feels like a trap. If God made this Peter, knowing the denial was hard-coded into his concept, how can we blame Peter? Peter can just look up and say, hey, I was drawn this way. It's in my file.
It is the ultimate defense, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But Leibniz makes a crucial distinction here between certainty and necessity. This is probably the hardest part of his philosophy to grasp, so bear with me.
Okay, break it down for us. Certainty versus necessity.
It is certain that Peter will deny Jesus because God chose to create this version of Peter. God knows it will happen, but it is not logically necessary.
What is the difference?
Necessary in logic means the opposite implies a contradiction.
Yeah.
Like a square circle. A square circle is impossible. It cannot exist.
Right.
Peter not denying Jesus isn't a square circle. It isn't impossible. Logically, there are other possible Peters in God's mind who didn't sin.
So there was a Peter Beta in God's mind who stood loyal. A Peter 2.0.
Exactly. There are infinite possible Peters in the mind of God.
Yeah.
There's a Peter who stayed loyal. A Peter who ran away. A Peter who became a merchant and never even met Jesus.
Okay.
But, and this is key, God didn't choose to make those Peters real. He chose this one.
Why? Why bring the Peter who fails into the game? That seems cruel. Why not pick the loyal Peter?
Because according to Leibniz, this Peter, flaws, denial, and all, was more suited to the supreme ends of God's wisdom. The denial wasn't just a glitch. It was a necessary plot point for the specific history God wanted to write.
And does that history include Peter's redemption? Because Peter does come back.
Yes. And this is where the robot accusation starts to fade a little bit. Because Peter repents. And Leibniz says, this introduces the role of divine grace.
How does that work? Does God reach in and tweak the code to force him back?
No, because that would violate Peter's nature. Instead, God acts on the inclination. Think of it this way. God doesn't force the donkey to walk. He just holds out a really, really delicious carrot.
The carrot being grace.
Right. God makes the good repentance, love, truth appear so beautiful, so desirable to Peter's mind that his will naturally rushes toward it. He isn't forced. He is charmed. He is wooed.
I really like that distinction. It's not mind control. It is persuasion. It's making the good irresistible. But let's bring this down to earth for a second. Most of us aren't biblical figures. We're just trying to stop eating junk food or stop doom scrolling at 2 a.m.
Right. The daily struggles we all face.
If we follow our strongest desires and our desires come from our nature, how do we ever change? Are we just stuck until God waves a carrot? How do we actually escape our own programming?
That is the escape hatch. Leibniz asks, can we modify our own nature? If I'm a soda drinker by nature, am I stuck? And his answer is no, because we have a specific tool.
What is the tool?
Reflection. Mature deliberation.
Mature deliberation. That sounds like something my parents would tell me to do when I was a teenager.
It is very good advice. Leibniz argues that we naturally pursue what appears to be good. You drink the soda because it appears tasty. You doom scroll because it appears stimulating. But these are confused appearances.
We're being tricked by surface level data.
Exactly. We are reacting to the immediate sensation. But Leibniz says we have a superpower. We can suspend our action. We can hit the pause button.
The pause button. I like that a lot.
We can refuse to act until we have reflected. When you pause, you allow your reason to kick in. You analyze the soda. You realize, okay, it tastes good for 5 seconds, but it spikes my sugar, makes me crash, and ruins my diet. You clarify the thought.
And once the thought is clarified, the desire actually changes.
That's the magic of it. When you truly understand rationally that something is bad for you, you stop wanting it. Or at least the desire weakens significantly. By using your reason to clarify your ideas, you are actually reprogramming your own inclinations.
So freedom isn't just doing whatever I feel like. Freedom is actually the ability to stop, think, and hack your own programming so that you feel like doing the right thing.
Precisely. Freedom is tied to rationality. The more clearly you think, the freer you are. If you're just acting on impulse, you're a slave to your biology. If you're acting on reflection, you're a free agent.
That is incredibly empowering. It takes the robot theory and throws it right out the window. We aren't static code. We are self-rewriting code.
We are code that can read itself and make updates. That is the true essence of Leibnizian freedom.
But we have to zoom out here. We've talked about me, the vending machine, Peter, and the pause button. But you cannot talk about Leibniz without talking about his most controversial and honestly most ridiculed idea, the theodicy.
The best of all possible worlds.
This is the big hurdle. Because we look around the world and we see cancer, we see war, we see innocent people suffering, we see earthquakes, and Leibniz stands there and says, this is the best it could possibly be. It sounds insane. It sounds like toxic positivity on steroids.
He does. It sounds offensive to modern ears. And Voltaire, the famous French writer, absolutely roasted him for it. You know the book, Candide.
Oh, yeah. Professor Pangloss walking through the ruins of an earthquake, missing an eye and an ear, smiling and saying, everything is for the best. It is biting satire.
It is brilliant satire. But the satire actually misses Leibniz's real point. Leibniz isn't saying this earthquake is fun. He's saying something much more structurally complex. He argues that God, being all-knowing, surveyed all possible worlds, infinite variations.
A world where the earthquake didn't happen. A world where I had tea instead of coffee. A world where gravity is slightly weaker.
Right. And out of those infinite options, God, being perfectly good, was morally bound to choose the absolute best one. Not just a good one, the maximum one.
But how can a world with rot and betrayal be the maximum good? How does that math even work?
Because Leibniz views the world like a symphony or a massive painting. If you put your face 2 inches away from a Rembrandt painting, what do you see?
Just dark, messy blotches, brush strokes that don't make any sense.
Exactly. It looks like a mistake. It looks ugly. But if you step back 10 feet, you see that the dark shadow is actually creating the depth that makes the light on the face shine. It's the contrast.
So evil is its shading.
Evil is privation. It's a lack, a limitation. But Leibniz believes there is no purposeless evil. Every bit of sorrow, every betrayal, every disaster is a dissonant chord that is absolutely necessary for the resolution of the final harmony.
That is a really hard pill to swallow if you are the one being the dissonant chord.
It is incredibly hard. And Leibniz doesn't deny the pain. He doesn't say it doesn't hurt. But he asks us to trust the trajectory. He views reality as dynamic creation, fall, redemption, leading to the city of God. You can't judge the movie by the scene where the hero is at his absolute lowest point.
So God could have created a world without that pain that's metaphysical necessity. He had the power to make a soft, fluffy world where nothing ever goes wrong.
Yes, he absolutely could have.
But because he is wise, he knew that the soft, fluffy world wouldn't result in the highest ultimate good. So he was bound by moral necessity to pick this jagged one.
Exactly. A world without Judas might be a nicer world, but it would be a world without the specific redemption story of the cross. And Leibniz bets that the redemption story is worth the cost of the betrayal.
It is a staggering level of trust in the architecture of history. But I have to play the skeptic here for a minute. We have to address the critics from the sources. Does this actually hold up? Or is this whole compatibilism thing, this idea that God plans everything, but we are still free, just a giant word game?
That is the core of the compatibilist debate. And there are plenty of thinkers who say, nice try, Leibniz, but no.
Who's the heavyweight champion against this in our source?
Our source highlights Bill Hasker. He is an ardent indeterminist. And his beef is very simple. If my choices are caused by my nature, and my nature is caused by God, then ultimately God causes my choices.
It's the dominoes again. If God sets up the dominoes, he can't be surprised when they fall. Hasker would say this inner inclination is just a mask for determinism.
Exactly. Hasker argues that Leibniz is just putting a friendly face on the fact that we are puppets. A puppet that loves its strings is still a puppet.
Ouch. So is there a defense against that, or do we just have to choose between Hasker and Leibniz?
Well, the source suggests Leibniz might be offering a fourth way.
A fourth way.
Usually we think in three categories. One, you're a robot, which is determinism. Two, it's all random, which is indeterminism. Or three, God wound the clock and left, which is deism. Leibniz offers a picture where God is continually imparting existence. It's not a static blueprint. It's a relationship.
What does that actually mean, imparting existence?
It means God is constantly supplying the power for you to be and constantly offering that curative grace. And you, through reflection, are constantly interacting with that offer. It's not that God wrote a script and walked away. It's that God is sustaining the stage, the actors, and the lighting moment by moment, inviting the actors to improvise toward the light.
So it's active. It's a dance, not a blueprint.
Ideally, yes. It attempts to preserve the sovereignty of God. He's still running the show. And the dignity of the human, we are still real participants.
So where does this leave us today? We've gone from thirsty he-men to the city of God. What is the takeaway for someone listening to this deep dive who just wants to get through their Tuesday?
I think the biggest takeaway is the power of the pause. Leibniz is telling us that we are heavily influenced by our nature, our genes, our upbringing, our habits. We cannot deny that.
We have inclinations. We have a tilt.
We do. But we are not slaves to them. We have the capacity to hack our own programming. By stopping to think, by asking, is this really good or does it just look good, we can actually change the trajectory of our lives.
We can align our will with something better. We can choose the carrot.
And on the macro scale, there is that challenging, difficult comfort of the best of all possible worlds.
It's not about ignoring pain. It's about a philosophical trust that the universe isn't just random chaos, that the story is actually heading somewhere.
That the discord is part of resolution we just can't hear yet.
And that leads to a really provocative thought I want to leave you, the listener, with today. We talked about Peter. We talked about mistakes. We talked about regrets. If Leibniz is right, if this really is the best of all possible worlds, constructed with infinite wisdom, think about your own life.
It changes the perspective completely.
Does it imply that every mistake you have ever made, every wrong turn, every deep regret was somehow necessary?
Not just necessary, but optimal.
Is your stumbling making the ground firmer for someone else? Was your Peter denying Jesus moment, whatever that looks like in your life, a prerequisite for your own redemption arc?
It stops you from viewing your past as a series of accidents and starts you seeing it as essential plot points.
Maybe you aren't a broken robot. Maybe you're just in the middle of the second act. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Keep reflecting.
See you next time.